Hi everyone, and welcome to the Curve Mindset Podcast with McGinley Coaching. I'm your founder and host, Laurie McGinley. Today we're joined by David Astill. How are you, David?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Can you just tell the listeners a bit of a background of yourself?
Yes, so I am head of women's football at Total Football Analysis, which is a tactics-based website that does kind of writes tactics-based content for football and does for various other sports as well, has sister sites. My role essentially is to look after the women's football side of things, to write about it. I cover the women's game all around the world in terms of writing. So that's kind of me.
And it must be really interesting at the moment because also we had the Euros last year and then we've obviously got the World Cup this year, you know, and it, just from the experience of writing, you know, you must have seen a big progression in women's football. I'm just looking to see what the kind of trends are have been happening in the last maybe 18 months, the last 2 years, you know, with money, but also you see like the Champions League with two English sides that are in it, and then you obviously, you've got this Barcelona machine, you know, Lyon, Bayern Munich, but also the European kind of market, but kind of trends that are happening in kind of Britain and then in Europe that you kind of seen that have helped make the game bigger?
Yeah, it's definitely growing and it's lovely to see. And you're absolutely right. You know, certainly in the build up to and certainly after the Euros, we've seen a huge hike in terms of popularity. More and more people wanting to read stuff, to write stuff, to watch games, to get involved in it. So, yeah, the popularity and the interest in the women's game has definitely grown. And it has been really, 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 really good to see. And hopefully long may it continue.
And trends-wise, you know, let's talk about kind of England and Scotland, because you cover Britain too. I'm just looking to see from the kind of managerial trends. You've seen like Emma Hayes, everyone, you know, what incredible manager she is. But you look at Mark Skinner, you're even down in Scotland, you know, Eva Olad, Hearts, who try to break that mould up to the top three. But I'm just seeing what kind of trends you've seen from managers that have tried, you know, in the kind of British game. And then also the a lot of it's kind of, if you got from the European game to the British game, you know, Jean Van Luc, the ex-Lyon manager, won multiple Champions Leagues and then got sacked after a very short amount of time in Everton. I'm just going to see how people perceive the game more in the kind of coaching world, in the British game and also in the European game, and if there's any kind of different tactics that people use, you know, or is it very similar, or is it just could be to do with budget?
I think it's every coach has their own style, and you can certainly see that managers will adapt tactics depending on where they're from. So, for example, Eva Olid's tactics at Hearts, there's a lot of Spanish influence in there. There's some American influence as well from when she was coaching over there. Emma Hayes, you can see that her tactics develop over time. She almost makes little tweaks here and there depending on what she's got in her squad. You look at when she changed to wing backs because she felt that she had a season where Fionnuala Harder wasn't really at her best in the sort of 4-4-2 or 4-2-3-1 that they were playing, or 4-3-3. So she changed wing backs. So she's continually adapting depending on what's happening in the squad. And, you know, Jonas Eidevall as well at Arsenal is a good example because he changed Arsenal's style slightly. He kept the same formation but just made little bits here and there. They play a bit more possession-based now. They're a bit more narrow. They play a lot of passes kind of through short, small areas of the pitch to really progress the ball through opposing lines. And yeah, you can definitely see that every coach has their own style, and sometimes that doesn't work. You know, Jean-Luc Vasseur is a prime example of that. You know, he came to England with his style of play. It didn't work. Yann Schuyer came to Brighton and tried to implement his high-pressing style. It didn't work. So as much as every coach has their own style, it also depends on what's happening in the league and what the players that they have at their disposal.
Yeah, it's interesting because you see Brighton, everyone raves about Brighton, the main side, and the Brentford women, main side too, and these kind of, you've got these models, but sometimes, like I was listening to the High Performance podcast, and their chief executive explained that sometimes we get things wrong, you know, like anyone else. But I think that you look at patience, because you look at, you know, the, is it the ex-Arsenal manager.
Joe Montemurro.
Yeah, sorry, my brain has went. That's it's right. Been a long, long one already. But he's, but he was at Arsenal for a long time. But do you think there's more sustainability in the kind of women's game if you can keep yourself at a higher level? You know, look at Gareth the Manchester City manager. He signed another 1 year deal, 2 year deal, 3 year deal. You know, it's, he's been there for a while now. But again, it's all about, can we, do you think having that kind of success and just building on one place at a time, or improving the, you know, the points difference, can keep you in the game a little bit longer in the women's game?
Yeah, I do. And again, I think it comes down to just noticing little bits here and there. You know, come back to Emma Hayes, the fact that she's been at Chelsea for so long shows that if you've got a manager who understands what it takes and who is happy to put each building block in place in turn and not rush things and not try to get to that finished article, but just make sure that every single building block is in place so that when you get to that finished article, as they clearly have done now, you can see the progression. You can see where they've made little changes here and there. Hope Powell as well at Brighton, you could see that she was just building a little bit, and unfortunately this season it just got away from her and from the team. But yeah, certainly those who stick around for a long time, you can see that they are making little changes here and there. So yeah.
Yeah, because that's the, we look at world-class coaches, and we focus a lot on the kind of British game and the European game, but there's going to be, I know you wrote an article in one of the Corinthians women's side, you know, or one of your colleagues, and it was really interesting on everyone focuses on the British and the European managers when there's actually a lot of good managers out there that are not recognised, but they're winning, you know, the Copa del Libertadores, all these, the versions of the European Cup, but they're just, it's really interesting, you start to see everyone, like the Roma manager, you know, very unknown, then he's just won the championship and got to the latter stage of the Champions League. But again, it's all about, as you say, tweaks, making it better. But that kind of goes to kind of the, when the, kind of England won the Euros, really interesting. But the thing that really fascinated me was the fact is Serena Wiegmann never changed at 11. She had the same subs, very similar subs. But I read something that was really interesting about the her coaching staff throughout it, that see when she was ill, or I think she got COVID, the assistant manager knew exactly what to do, how to develop this. Do you think having that trust with your kind of the manager, assistant manager, head coach, three or four people that are in the same wavelength, that the players will trust that a little bit more? Because you'll have a game plan, but that's why I was reading that information, she said in an interview, that if I'm ill or anything, we do training, that I step out, but the assistant does exactly the same thing, because therefore it's the same message. Do you think that's the kind of a really good thing in football, but more importantly in women's football, there's a continuity about it?
Yeah, hugely. I don't think it's just women's football, I think it's just football in general. Yeah. I think, you know, you always see when managers, I mean, I do personally, whenever I see a manager appointed, I always look to see, have they brought their long-term assistant with them? And I'm always happy when they have, because you can tell then that they've got that understanding. You can tell they've got that partnership, which you need. And as you say, it helps when you've got, say, there's a need for the manager to step out and the assistant manager steps up and there's no change in, you know, the force, if you like. The style is exactly the same. The players know what is expected of them. They know what they need to do on the pitch. So it's hugely important for me that there is that understanding between coaching staff and the manager. And I think it's not just assistants either. You sometimes look at, say, Maurizio Pochettino as well, who has his whole team who goes with him to every single club. Emma Hayes at Chelsea, again, you know, there's three of her key lieutenants there. Denise Reddy, Paul Green, who were the two that stepped in when she took time away earlier this season, and Stuart Searle, who's the other one, the goalkeeping coach. Those three have been in that team for a very, very long time. and you can tell the understanding that they have, and you can tell that the players respect the fact that they are on board with what Emma Hayes wants. They know her style and her tactics and everything like that. Jonas Eidel this season brought in one of his former Rosengard assistants to help with set pieces. So he's also in that sort of frame of, yes, we need players, who, coaches who know the club, but we also, I want someone that knows what I want to do. Which means that, again, if he ever needs to take some time away, he would have someone who would go, yeah, I've worked with him for a long time. I know what he wants to do.
Yeah, because we look at the kind of the backlash of the Euros, and you've got certain teams that have succeeded really well and some were not. But, well, there's a lot of politics involved, but you look at the Spanish team, you know, like they pushed England to the absolute limit, you know, and it was maybe what that amazing the goal that scored, you know, from one of the England players, but it was just that kind of way of thinking that little bit of magic happens, but then the fallout is half their squad doesn't want to play for the World Cup anymore, and it's like even the you look at France too, you know. It's incredible, you know, these players have this such power, but because they're the ones who actually have to perform on the day. But this kind of is really interesting from a kind of analytical point of view, because you need to you talked about having two or three people, like analysis, set pieces, but there's going to be times, see in the World Cup, there's going to be times when analysis actually wins you the game, you know, more. This is, do you think having a dedicated analysis department for a kind of country, you know, a nation is actually key, because a lot of these people, a lot of these coaches rely on this information. So I'm just looking to see, do you think having that extra bit of information, like the marginal gains, is important, having head coach, assistant coach? But again, it could be 10 people or it could be 3 people, but it just all depends on obviously budgets. But do you think analysis is going to potentially win you something later on? Because we talked about in the kind of men's World Cup, the set pieces, like corners, were the biggest thing, you know, winning. But now everyone kind of has an idea of set plays. Everyone has a similar way of thinking, but then there's other people who just have that extra little bit of edge through analysis, through opposition and their own. Do you think in the World Cup, this is going to be a big, big factor, analysis?
Yeah, I do, because there's going to be so many different styles that you're going to have to get used to. And I think that's the thing about the World Cup is you haven't got that time to build up to it. So you need people who are going to say, look, we haven't got a lot of time in the coaching on the training ground, but here is that little detail that they do that we can capitalise on. So, yeah, I completely agree that at the World Cup, when time is against you, you haven't got a full year to build up to things, for example. You have to get it right on the day. I do think that having people who will be able to spot little weaknesses or little strengths that you've got and bring those to the coaching staff and say, if we do this, we have a good chance of doing that, for example. I think that is going to give people the edge.
And this is kind of the main part of it. Like, the World Cup is going to be, because we looked at France, 4 years ago, you know, and this is where I kind of have this kind of way of thinking of, there's a lot of top teams and there's teams that are kind of developing, you know, still, but you look at I know the USA got a lot of backlash by beating, you know, like the one of the weaker teams, like 13-14-0, but is that a bad thing or a good thing? Because end of the day, you can look at it in a way, I'm going to be ruthless, but then what if, you know, England won 13-14-0 or another team won? It wouldn't be as perceived as that bad sometimes because of the way the media works. But I'm just looking to see from your analysis point of view, do you think this actually helps them when they're actually going to beat teams 4-5-6 because therefore they can actually exploit more weaknesses in the opposition? But then the player, devil's advocate, if you're beating teams 14-15-0, you're not really getting pushed. So therefore, we can exploit that. Oh, let's say the ball goes to the right wing. You know, we know that press could happen. So therefore, if we beat that press, then we could, you know, beat the USA. Let's say there's a chance to counter on them. But do you think it having big scores is an advantage or disadvantage, or it could work in both levels?
I think it could work both ways. You could argue for disadvantage that it leads to complacency because teams think perhaps, you know, this is easy or whatever, and that can then lead to them perhaps forgetting that that team that they're playing is near the bottom of the rankings, and therefore they're expected to win by a comfortable margin, maybe not by that comfortable, but by a comfortable margin. But I think from an advantage point of view, it can also be hugely positive for them because it can allow them to experiment a bit more. You know, if you're winning 6-7-0, say by 60 minutes, and you know you've got half an hour left, well, you can then look to perhaps change things around a bit, maybe play around with the style, introduce a few new players that you're not quite sure how they fit in. Use that time to experiment a bit so that when you get to those tougher times, you can go, well, actually, we need something like, I don't know, we need a deep line distributor. And we found in that previous game that actually the person who is best suited to that role is the person who sat next to me on the bench. So I'm going to get them on. You wouldn't know that had you not played around with that a little bit in that earlier game. And regarding whether it's a positive thing to have these results, I think I never blame a team for scoring that many, because ultimately they can only play what's in front of them on the day, and that's the same in any sport. You know, you can only play what's in front of you, and if that team in front of you just for whatever reason is having a bad day or is so far down the rankings they just can't cope, you know, with constant waves of attacking pressure, and you end up scoring 11, 12, 13, 14 nil, that's ultimately what happens. And unfortunately in women's football, there are a few scores like that. You know, the 11-0, I think it was, USA against Thailand in 2019 was a prime example. But that's not the USA's fault. They were drawn against Thailand. You know, that was pure luck on both sides, or in Thailand's case, pure bad luck. But you know, you can't blame the USA for going out and taking Thailand to shreds in that sense. They're at a World Cup. They want to win. Of course, they're going to go out and attack. So for me, I think, you know, there is an argument to say big results don't really do women's game that many favours in terms of keeping teams level and making it instantly exciting. But at the same time, you can't blame the teams for going out because they want to win. They want to go and show what they can do. And the only way they're going to do that is by scoring as many goals as they can.
Yeah, and this is the thing, because you're going to have the favourites of the US, but we've also got the Dutch, you've got the Scandinavian countries, they come in really because of the technical aspect, I love it. You know, you've got England, you've got, you know, France, a very interesting, after, you know, appointing the ex-Saudi Arabia manager. And it's just, do you think that this is more of a, there's going to be times where you're going to have the better teams against the better teams, you know, it's usually in the latter stages, but that's why I think it's really interesting about the analysis, because this is what you say, that marginal gains. But looking at the kind of latter stages, obviously you can't take anything in, you know, a pinch of salt. But who do you think is going to be the kind of favourites, but also a team that might actually surprise you, and then maybe a team that might disappoint you? Because these are kind of, you've always got these teams that are hyped so well. Like, again, the Euros with the Dutch, they were expected to do well and they didn't really do much, you know, but then you expected England for England to do well, and they exceeded the expectation. But I think they won 30 games in a row for the time they, you know, got to, you know, that kind of final. But I'm just looking to see who you think is the favourites, who's going to be the ones who are going to surprise you and ones who are going to disappoint you.
I think it's really difficult to look past the United States as favourites. I know they've obviously got a few issues here and there with, you know, the midfield is not quite set, and they're obviously going to miss Mal Swanson, and who's a fantastic player, really like her. Becky Sauerbrunn as well has been ruled out with injury, their captain. So they are missing a few key ingredients, and there's still a few things to settle, but I think they'll have enough. Because they can rotate, and they've played a couple of players in different positions, and it's sort of worked enough that it could work in a game, or, you know, things like that. So I think they'll have enough. And certainly the way the NWSL is going, you know, there's a lot of players that currently in form that you think, yeah, they're going to have a good World Cup, you would hope. So I wouldn't really look past them as the favourites for me. I think England will be up there, but the injuries, I think, will just prevent them from lifting it. I may be wrong. I hope I'm wrong, obviously, but I just can't see it happening. The team that I think actually could surprise, and it's probably going to surprise people that I say this, is Australia, because I don't think there's a lot being said about them. And yet, for me, they are in really good form. Every time I watched them play, they've got a really good style. They've got, you know, obviously Sam Kerr's not had her best season, but she's still a threat. You've got Caitlin Ford, who is probably had one of her strongest seasons at Arsenal in terms of in the final third. Steph Catley and Ellie Carpenter, both back in and looking sharp. They play a really good style. They like to use the width. They've got options in the middle. They can progress the ball through the thirds, and they've got that attacking threat at the other end as well. There's a few defensive issues, as there is with any team, but for me, I think they're the team that could stand out, particularly as they're in front of their home fans. And I just think they'll get buoyed on by that. They'll get that fan appreciation, if you like, which I think a lot of people are kind of looking at the States and England and maybe Germany and Sweden as the favourites. I wouldn't rule Australia out of getting to a semi-final, maybe even a final.
And then the team that maybe disappoint you?
I think Italy. They don't have, you know, look at the Euros, those big tournaments they don't turn up to. I mean, Italy have got some really, really good players, and they should be doing better than they have done. I can't remember what they did in the last World Cup off the top of my head, but I know the Euros, I was really disappointed with them. They were completely outplayed, particularly by France in that opening game. I think they're ones that could disappoint. I struggle to think. New Zealand, I think, unfortunately, just not in great form. They haven't won since September last year. They've only picked up one draw since the turn of the year, and every other game has been a defeat. I know there's questions over the coaching staff as well. Klimkova has been under pressure, their head coach. So for me, they're in a tough group as well, because they've got Norway and the Philippines and Switzerland in Group A. So for me, I think that's a group that could harm their chances. They've got the potential to get through if they can get things kind of, you know, get into gear. But I just think the way things are going for them, I don't think it will happen.
You talk about obviously Norway, but the Sweden, they're ranked as kind of, I think, they're third in the world. And it was a really interesting point. It was Mia Eriksson. She put it on our Twitter or some a kind of lead football journalist. She said, if Sweden's men were third in the world, they were more hype. But there's actually not as much hype for the women's side. But they're actually very, very good. So do you think, I know you talk about Australia, but do you think this World Cup will actually, because it really helped England, you know, and the kind of Britain in general and kind of women's football. But do you think having it kind of further away actually helps the worldwide a bit more, a bit more exposure? But again, my question is always this. See the teams that are hyped the most, sometimes they fail the most times. As you say, like Italy, they've actually a very good squad, but they don't perform too well in the big occasions. But do you think this is going to be a big wake-up call for a lot of the kind of the bigger, like the FIFA and UEFA, about, you know, pay, but also just, I know they had to take a little bit of time, a lot more than the TV deals, because then, of course, FIFA was saying about a blackout deal and all this, but again, everything got resolved. But do you think having the hype for more women's football is actually going to help grow the game more with finance, with sponsor, but also having a really successful Women's World Cup? Because I know in France they sold out every single stadium. Hopefully it's the same in Australia and New Zealand, but do you think that's a big factor, having the men and women equal, you know, like hype wise because it's really interesting. I didn't know that, you know, Sweden were third in the world, but now you find out and it's like, wow, what a team. But again, it's all about, you know, the progression. Do you think it's going to happen soon, or do you think it's going to be another wee while before it kind of steps another level?
I think we're starting to see the signs already of improvement in that regard. But I think there's still a way to go. I think you look at, you know, we're still hearing reports of pay disputes, of players complaining they're not getting the right support. I think Jamaica came out in the last week and said they're the latest team to say they're not getting the right level of support from their federation, I believe. Obviously, we've had Canada, France, Spain have had their issues. So I think there are certainly improvements in the way that women's footballers are being treated by their federations, and in terms of the support and the financial backing and things like that. But I think there's still a way to go. So whilst the World Cup, I think, will be a huge positive because it will show the world that the women's game is growing and it's hugely popular, and it's people want to watch it. And you look at the amount of fan interest in terms of wanting to go to the stadiums to watch it, to sell out those stadiums. I hope they are sell out. They are sell outs. I know they've. I think they've already sold the most they've ever sold for the World Cup in terms of tickets. Could be wrong about that. But I do think that we're starting to see the signs of improvement. But yeah, there's still a way to go for me. There's still a lot of issues that we need to sort out globally as well.
And you look at in England, you've got Chelsea are dominating a lot of the teams, but the Man United now, Arsenal. But then you look at Aston Villa, really incredible. I listened to Carla Ward on a podcast and it's really interesting. But she talks about managing the players, but also having that expectation of I could get to the top four, but we're here, but we need to move ourselves up to. We can't go from 10th to 1st or 10th to 2nd. We have to move. Do you think the Park League, the Super League, is going to be a bit more tighter again next year? Because it got to a title race, with Arsenal, with Man United. And obviously, with Arsenal's injuries, it didn't help, but done really well to get. But do you think that Chelsea will, because she's a very good coach, but there was the rumours that she might leave after another, maybe next year or a year after. But again, it's all about that kind of consistency. But do you think the Super League will be a competitive league again? But also, I'm just looking at the time, but the Champions League too, Barcelona, Lyon, Wolfsburg, it's the same, very similar quarterfinals all the time. Do you think that Real Madrid, obviously the powerhouses in the men's game, but are not as much in the women's game. Do you think that the Barclays will be pushed, but also do you think there's going to be more English teams in the Champions League because of finance and also not as much vision for the kind of European game?
Yeah, I do. I think we'll continue to see the WSL grow from strength to strength. I think the fact that Aston Villa, who only, let's not forget, a couple of seasons ago they were battling against relegation, they've now signed the Dutch goalkeeper Daphne van Domselaar, who starred at the Euros and a couple of years ago you wouldn't have imagined her going to a team like Aston Villa, but it shows how well Villa are doing. I think for me it shows that there are other teams as well who are starting to attract top players. And it's really, really positive. And I think also you can see in Europe as well that it's not just Barcelona that are starting to attract those top players in Spain. Real Madrid are starting to get some good names, like Caroline Weir as well. You wouldn't really have thought she could go to a team like Real Madrid a couple of years ago, because they weren't doing as well, but they're starting to really progress. And France, I think you've got PSG as well as Lyon. So, in each country, you've got a few teams that are really starting to grow. And Germany, Hoffenheim and Frankfurt as well. Two really, really good teams, well worth watching. So I think long and short of it is, in the future, I think we will see more teams start to compete. There is still a big divide between them. But I think that in each country, we're starting to see a few more, the gaps are starting to be bridged a little bit. And hopefully that means in the future that we'll see a bit more competitiveness in the European competitions as well.
And then in the Super League, do you think Chelsea will win it again next year? Or do you think it's going to be like a Man United? Or is it more of it's anyone's guess at the moment? Because it is getting tighter and tighter.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to recruitment, really. We've obviously seen Chelsea recruiting quite well. Macario, Nicky Everard, the Belgian goalkeeper. Ashley Lawrence has been linked. Obviously, Shuk and Nuskin's come in. I think we have to wait and see how Man United respond, how Man City respond, how Arsenal respond in terms of signings before we make too many comparisons. At the moment, Chelsea are looking strong. But yeah, recruitment, I think, will be key, because if those other three don't get the right players in, then they could very easily fall away. Chelsea, as I say, comes back to what you were saying, they just always find those little building blocks, and that's what they're doing this season. They've identified little positions here and there they can just tweak or bring someone in to just develop a little bit. And certainly that's what's happened in the WSL. So, yeah, again, I think it will probably be Chelsea's at this point in time, but we won't really be able to make too many general, you know, proper statements, if you like, until we see at the start of the season how the teams are shaping up, particularly when it comes to Arsenal, because obviously they'll still have their injuries. You know, Williamson's likely to miss the majority of the season, much like Tejas did this season. So we won't really see how they can do until we see on that opening day what they're looking like. Same with United, same with City. So for me, I think, yes, at this point in time, Chelsea, but we have to reserve judgment until we see what the recruitment's going to be like.
Okay. Thank you again, David, for your time.